The next page is 96, 26, 24, Francis Hamilton versus Ohio Savings Bank. Justice Sweeney has recused himself from participating in this case. We're very pleased to have sitting in place of Justice Sweeney, Judge Joseph Vukovich, who is a judge of the Court of Appeals sitting in the 7th District. Welcome.
Thank you.
Mr. Weiss.
Counsel, with regard to the numerosity criteria, you make the point that we ought to look at this in terms of two claims in 12 years. And two claims in 12 years? Okay, it's your other.
The bank says that this case has been pending for 12 years. Actually, it's been pending for 13, and in that 13-year period, only two individuals have filed a lawsuit. Of course, in a class action, it's only necessary to have one file a lawsuit. And somehow, you're saying that because there's a class apathy, there's somehow a lack of finding numerosity. Numerosity is based strictly on numbers, and clearly the numbers in this case satisfy the numerosity requirement.
Yes, thanks.
Let me ask you a question. If it seems to me that what you're seeking are actually subclasses. I mean, we have to almost have to decide whether there are subclasses here. Do we not? There's not, doesn't seem to be one class because the plaintiffs, the 2,700 people, are in different, very different situations. So don't we need to break down, as the briefing has done, I mean, you've given us the reason to look at subclasses.
Is that right? I'm sorry.
And if you agree, then move along. If you agree, who represents classes 3, subclasses 3 and 4, if we call them classes? Who represents?
I believe that some of the claims of subclasses 3 and 4 are really just a subset of the claims of classes 1 and 2. The claims of classes 3 and 4 arise from the idea that, you know, they're charging interest at one rate and disclosing interest at another rate. That fundamental flaw that pervades or permeates every particular class member is an issue that is present in the claims of both Francis Hamilton and George Barber cited out.
But in three and
subset is the best way to look at it.
Do you agree with the appellee here that the Court of Appeals did err in its rationale in determining that in all cases, really, the typicality requirement comes from the requirement of the balloon payment at the end of the loan?
Actually, I think what the Court of Appeals did is when they set out the four classes.
Let me just ask you: Do classes 3 and 4include or encompass folks who have to make a balloon payment or not?
It's not a question I can answer standard that is, and I'm not trying to be difficult.
Sure.
Subclass three would include persons who, if they sell their home, there will be a balloon. If they're foreclosed upon, there will be a balloon. If they refinance their loan, there will be a balloon.
But the payments are, the whole cause of action, isn't it that the payments were not properly amortized? And in this case, in both of those cases, if one were to pay their loan in the normal course, no balloon payment results.
Or,
can't do.
It's the issue is not so much the question of how much, the issue so much isn't the question of the amortization failure, although that is part of the problem. The amortization failure is one of the manifestations of the underlying problem. The underlying problem is that they're telling the public they're doing one thing, and in their computer system they're doing something very different. That's, and for different, depending on if you're a pre-1978 borrower, you will have a balloon. If you're a post-1978 borrower, you won't. Remember, 1978.
Some of the loans are retired and some aren't.
Well, just to clarify something so that we're not all confused, subclasses 2 and 4 are the ones with outstanding loans, and classes 1 and 3 are the groups with the retired loans. Is that correct?
That's my understanding also, so we need to clarify that, I guess.
We need to clarify that.
Okay, well, the point is this. There are two classes whose loans will not amortize to zero. They are retired loans and outstanding loans. There's two classes whose loans will retire to zero should they go to term. And within that group, there are retired and unretired loans. I
bet the court of appeals opinion looking at it says accordingly subclasses 2 and 4 are those borrowers with outstanding loans, and 1 and 3 are those with retired loans. So we'll rely on the appeals.
But even those that are retired, they add another couple of years in order to amortize them because of the balloon that exists but doesn't have to be paid if you elect. I guess my problem with this was, looking at the classes, do I read the case accurately that there's still, except for FHA and maybe Fannie Mae mortgages, that they're still doing the 365-360 thing in their loans?
They're still doing it, and they're still describing it as something that doesn't include, in other words, a 10% loan, it would be 10.13%.
Yes.
Today, Ohio Savings Bank gave you or me a 10% loan, it would say 10% if it was not written on FHA or VA paper.
And then really it's 10.3 or probably 10.13. Yes.
That's true. It's still going on. And not only is it going on in the sense that they're still doing it, but it's going on in the sense that Mr. Seidel here, his loan is still existing. So, I mean, he's today, every time he makes his payment, too much of that goes towards interest and not enough.
Is he one of the people they sent the notice to that there's been some mistake called to our attention, so you can either amortize it by a greater payment each month or add 2 years so you don't have a balloon?
No, the notices that were sent to the absent class members, which he's not one, he's a named claimant, was done secretly. It was purely, I think a friend of mine's parent or something got one of these letters. That's how I found out about it. It was purely serendipity that I even was made aware of that, what I would call unsavory conduct.
So if you borrowed $100,000 from Ohio Savings today and they told you the interest rate was 7%, it would be amortized in equal payments over 15 years.
It would amortize at zero.
It would amortize at zero.
But it's not a 7% loan.
Well, if it's a greater interest rate, then the total amount of money should be more.
It is.
Well, then how can it amortize if they...
They charge... In the pre-1978 class, at the end, you're correct, there's a balloon.
Yeah,
in the post-1978 classes, some piece of that balloon is paid each month. They increase the monthly payments to account for the balloon. But the central issue, the common issue that permeates, underlines, encompasses, wraps this entire case, is that they're doing one thing, they're telling the public one thing, and their computer system is doing something entirely
different. Yeah, but unless somebody's injured, that doesn't bring about a cause of action.
But everybody is in.
Okay, so that's why I asked you. In fact, 7% amortized over 15 years, divided the way we would normally divide it, it will not amortize over exactly 15 years unless you increase the monthly payment or you add 2 years or whatever it is to the end of the note.
That's a fair statement.
Okay, if that's a fair statement, then isn't our only legal issue here the difference between these classes, whether you have really two major legal issues, or there's one that's kind of secondary, but it's more important to me, and that's the tolling of the statute of limitations. Because the issue, I think, is whether whenever you file a class action suit, does that toll the limitation statute to everybody? And the federal law clearly says it does.
Now, I have to tell you, I haven't researched, I haven't researched every statement. I'm unaware of any statement that says.
Okay, now, isn't our, the primary issue before that, however, is whether the people who are, in fact, have retired their mortgages, can be in a, and are seeking damages, can be a certified class. Isn't that really our issue?
Well, that's one of the issues. Clearly, the way the class action sits now, the Court of Appeals said that for people who have existing loans, they can pursue their claims in the class action format and obtain injunctive relief so that it doesn't happen in the future. With respect to people in the past, they cannot possibly be made whole with that type of relief. Money's already gone. You know, and I think it's important to realize how this occurs in probably 9 out of 10 times.
So they're seeking money damages.
Right.
So that's the distinction between the classes.
But isn't the reason the Court of Appeals denied them class certification is because they said that they would have to look at each individual member of the retired class to determine whether the statute of limitations has run?
That's true. And then 2 points I want to make. A, that's true. B, I think implicit in that ruling is the idea that the Court of Appeals didn't think that there were any other individualized issues that really were a problem here. What they were troubled with was the statute of limitations issue. Clearly, on a contract claim, that's not an issue. The 15-year statute of limitations, I filed this class action in January 30th, I believe, of 1985. Statute of limitations for all potential class members told at that time. If you take 15 years, 1985 minus 15 years is 1970. Anybody whose problem began 1970, from 97 to present, is included in class. This whole program, 365 or 360 program, didn't even start until 1972. So the breach of contract is no, I don't want to say that it's rude, but it should be a non-issue. With respect to the other question of the statute of limitations issue, as far as equitable tolling is concerned, the U.S. Supreme Court in the Bowen case has held that equitable tolling is not a bar to class certification. And I've cited a number of the antitrust cases, and I would ask the court, if you have time, I know you're busy, but really, if there's any case, recent case, that gives a thoughtful discussion of the statute of limitations issue, and just the way in which courts can go about handling, creative ways that courts can go about handling in a judicious, economic way, potential individual issues. I would direct the court's attention to the case that we cited called In Re, NASDAQ, Market Makers Antitrust Litigations. In Re, NASDAQ, Market Makers Antitrust Litigation, 169, FRD 493. And they said their courts overwhelmingly held that even when the issue of fraudulent concealment involves both common and individual questions, the common question of whether the defendant successfully concealed the existence of the alleged conspiracy predominates over any individual questions. The authority is overwhelming, and I think, again, we get back to the Ocalvo test, lack of articulated rationale, weight of authority clearly militates in favor of permission.
Let me make sure I understand the legal issues here on the merits. You would not argue on the merits if you get to them, that there is some law that prevents Ohio Savings from charging their customers in this way, too. There's not some statement of law that could be made that this violates federal statute or regulation that applies to all of the prospective plaintiffs.
Can I answer that in two ways, and I'm not trying to be coy? there's no rule that says directly, you cannot do this. What it does do is say, if you're going to do it, and you're going to do it in a way that creates more payment, you must disclose that.
So your argument is that each person who has a loan, one of these loans with Ohio Savings Bank, has been deceived in some way, or there's been a misrepresentation, or whatever you want to call it, or whatever you want to call it.
Well, certainly in this sense, Your Honor, I go to a bank, they say, just like Mr. Seidel, I want to obtain a 9% loan. They say, that's fine, you could apply for a 9% loan. You then get a letter from the loan committee saying, congratulations, you have a 9% per annum loan, these are what your payments are, so forth and so on. Come in and sign the final papers. You go in and sign the final papers. They show you a mortgage note, says 9%. They show you a truth in lending form, says 9%. They show you a mortgage deed, says, this is not something that arises in each individual transaction. This they must do, but there's no loan.
But didn't the Court of Appeals adopt, I guess, the appellee's argument that you have to know what the relationship was with the loan officer and the lendee in each of those situations to know whether there was misrepresentation?
I'm sorry, I interrupted. The only thing the Court of Appeals said in any way hinted at why they would not allow the damage classes, the classes of a damage claim, is the statute of limitations issue. There's nothing else. That's it, the statute of limitations. And I can tell you that on contract action, again, they're woefully mistaken. And on the other actions, even if equitable tolling is applied, you know, Your Honor, in this particular case, in Hamilton 1, 70 Ohio State, I think you offered the opinion, it says at the very end, it doesn't say that you have to, it says, I remand this case to the trial court. The trial court shall determine when each power should have discovered. It doesn't say knew or should know. It says should have discovered. You created an objective test for the statute of limitations issue.
Well, take the statute of limitations out of it, and then the issue of the discussions at the time the loan was made. That's the appellee's other argument, is that we can't know in a class action suit what the understanding was between each of the persons who obtained the loan. They may have been told, you know, that the document says 9%, but here's the reason it's actually more. Is that?
Can I just read you one sentence? OSBs, the Ohio Savings Bank's agreements, the Francis Hamilton and the Seidels are embodied in the notes. That's their statement, and I agree with it. Let me say this. You know, these people, they're running a bank. Think of foreclosure actions. Do you think I'm not asking you a question. It's not your job to answer my question. But would any of us think? When they're in the midst of a foreclosure action, that they're going to let the person that they're foreclosing on say, well, wait a minute. When I took out this loan, the my loan officer said, I can pay me on 30 days, and they won't foreclose on me. It doesn't happen. It's the four corners. Bank couldn't operate otherwise. They'd be out of business. They could not operate otherwise. Let me just say one thing before you're asking me to sit down.
I soon will.
Okay.
Thank you, Piper.
There's one thing that you can glean from looking at the attachments to the motion for summary judgment, the supplements of motion for summary judgment, and the supplements in this case. Banks are creatures of habit. They do not, they're not having one guy do this at this branch and this woman doing this at this branch and this one. They cannot operate that. It's a form business. They have to then pool all these mortgages eventually and sell them. That's what they're hoping to do. They can't have different understandings and different nuances for each loan. It's a form business. Banks operate by forms, habit, and custom. There's no other industry that's more suited to be involved in a class action
on
a bank.
Thank you, Mr. White. Mr. Stanley.
May it please the Court, Chief Justice Boyer. My name is Hugh Stanley. I'm the lawyer, and together with Mark Freeman and Roy Lodge, I have the pleasure of representing Ohio Savings Bank, the defendant, Abilene, Russell Pelham. Indeed, we did maintain the last time this case was before this court that the agreement of the parties was set forth in the notice. This was a position that was also maintained by the plaintiff. This court, however, decided that there were ambiguities with respect to the note, declined our request to affirm the summary judgment motion, and declined the invitation of the plaintiff to enter summary judgment on what they maintained was the fair intent of the note, and made his decision, which reversed the summary judgment. On the record before this court, we judge Corrigan's decision to deny certification pursuant to Rule 23 should be affirmed. We would ask this court to reverse the court and enter judgment affirming the trial court and remand these individual claims to the trial court for final resolution. It is well settled that the trial court is the gatekeeper for class action and is directly charged with the responsibility of making the determination based on frontline observations and analysis as to whether Rule 23, a procedural rule, can be applied to efficiently and economically, fairly resolve disputed common issues with respect to a large number of claimants in a single trial or a single proceeding.
If you don't have a class action here, how do you solve all these probably hundreds of loans that are all outstanding?
Your Honor, the individual questions that require analysis in these individual claims, these peculiar and individualized claims, should be treated as former retired Justice Wright suggested in the trial court opinion in the Franklin County Complex Court that you're familiar with, the Grubbs versus Ryan decision. They should go to small claims court where the individualized considerations raised by each one of these claims can be resolved.
So you want them to file 2,500 or 3,000 or 60,000 separate actions?
No, I don't think there will be 60,000.
Well, there might be as many as what? 12 or 14,000?
And to address a question I think that you asked, Your Honor, is Ohio Savings still using the 365-360
method? Yeah, I'm really curious
it
about that.
It is not still using the 365-360 method, not because there's anything illegal about it, but because you can't resell those mortgages if, in fact, that's what you intend to do, because the forms used by the reselling federal government, Fannie Mae, Jenny Mae, do not allow for a particular section for the 365-360 method. And that method, Your Honor, is not a hidden method.
But they could discount them to Huntington.
They please, Your Honor?
They could sell them to Huntington.
Well, I suppose they could sell them.
Okay, so it's only Fannie Mae and... It's only Fannie Mae and FHA that don't permit the 365-360.
They won't buy 365-360.
Right. Won't buy those kind of work.
And we haven't done it for the last 2 years, only for a matter of convenience.
Okay.
Our note, Your Honor, so that there is no misunderstanding, it provides in the Ferris's Hamilton and the Seidel's claim for interest, respectively, at 9.25% for Hamilton and 9% for Seidel, computed on the 365-360 method, and it's clearly identified in the note, and you couldn't identify it.
I read that language, and I think I'm a reasonably intelligent person, and I would never have guessed that that language meant that I would change my interest. In fact, I now would go back and look at my own note and see who said that. So I don't, your argument is clearly disclosed when you have something out here that says 9%. I have a difficult time reconciling those two.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. I would make only this point, that interest is the product of interest rate times amount over times amount.
Why does 360 use when you have 365 days a year? Who used that for what purpose?
Historically, and it is interesting to review the congressional record on the source of the 365-360 method, which is well over 100 years old. It's originally called the banker's method of computing interest. For reasons that...
For a greater return.
But it also is easier to apply in the absence of a computer, or so they said when Brian Kaplan discussed it.
Is that really reverse of the banker's dozen?
Yeah, that's exactly what the banker's dozen. Yes, Your Honor. But the point, Your Honor, is that the rate is utilized in determining what the interest is, and it has always been so. The problem with this particular note isn't that it was a 365-360, it's that we set the payment based on the 360-360 method, which allowed an accumulation of principal over the life of the loan, which after 29 years could amount to what the Seidels will have.
All right, let's get to the payment. You've already been sued, correct? And you send the letter out to any customer and tell them, we calculated this wrong, here's an option. You ever notify the court you were sending this letter out?
No, Your Honor.
Did you notify the plaintiff you were sending this letter out?
No, Your Honor.
And you called this letter in various places in your brief in a court of satisfaction, and you may or may not have used probation, I'm not certain. But you call it court of satisfaction. What did the bank give up?
I don't know that it is an important satisfaction, Your Honor. And the argument that was made in our brief was to point out that there was an individual question as to whether it would be paid money.
Not an important satisfaction.
I would have to look at the evidence of each particular matter. It wasn't intended to be an important satisfaction.
Then why didn't you call it that in the brief?
To the extent that our brief suggests that it was an important satisfaction, Your Honor, as opposed to a matter of fact to a determination between Ohio State Bank and any particular borrower, I would correct it and apologize for any misunderstanding.
So you admit the bank did something unfair?
I admit this, Your Honor, that letter was sent after the first complaint was filed, and Mr. Wine suggested that the bank was accumulating these balloons and not telling anybody about these balloons. In response to that, with our customers, we sent a letter to our customers, not to the Seidels, not to the Hamiltons, who were personally represented by the lawyers, telling them that here is a problem that has been brought to our attention. We now understand it to be a widespread problem, and you have an artificial, you have an accumulation of principal. If we hadn't have said that to them, Mr. Weiss would have continued and not changed his approach when he filed the amended complaint in October of 1985 and the second amended complaint in 1988. No longer could he say that we were hiding it from anybody. We sent him a letter and talked to our customers. Now, this was brought to the attention of the court, and Mr. Weiss had 80 or 90 of the letters, and the court 12 years ago decided not to issue a temporary restraining order, and there were no further communications with the bank. That particular complaint was not part of a sign of error in the court of appeal. Your Honor, let me
interrupt you, Counsel, Mr. Stanley. I want to get back to the standard for class action. Assuming that statute of limitations is not, let's assume that the balance is correct in the law and statute of limitations. How is it different than asbestos cases where there's a termination of liability and then the trial court has to look at individual situations that give rise to money damages? What's different? I mean, you make the argument that all these people have different possible damages. Well, so what? I mean, those have to be decided someplace. And so why not in one court in one action where the law is determined and then you apply the facts?
If the only question, Your Honor, was damages and that was the only distinction and difference, then of course you're right. And so would the class action cases around the country say. Unless somehow the damage question predominated over all other questions. In this particular case, we suggest that the trial court was correct in its decision to deny certification of the class because the seven-tier test of Warner versus Waste Management interpreting Rule 23 wasn't met. A 1 through 23A, 1 through 4, numerosity, commonality, typicality, and adequacy of representation, the implied obligation of clearly defining the class and having a representative of the clearly defined class. And then one of the subparts of 23B, only 2 and 3 are the ones suggested here, they aren't met. In this particular case, the peculiar individual facts of Francis Hamilton, the Seidels, and the putative class members determine the causes of action fled in the defenses to those causes of action.
Well, but can you be specific?
The subclass.
Yes, Your Honor. I can be specific. Peculiar and particular individual facts are required to be established, and the determination of the causes will depend upon the peculiar facts regarding the understanding and intent of the parties regarding the amortization schedule and the calculation of interest. Peculiar and independent facts will determine the cause of action with regard to representation, disclosure, and reliance, reasonable or unreasonable.
Mr. White says those would all be the same in every case because the banks use forms and there's a standard procedure.
Your Honor, when this case was before this court on motion for summary judgment, we argued strenuously with the court that the agreement of the parties is set forth in this agreement. This was argued strenuously by Mr. White, and the court said that there are questions, individualized questions, with respect to reliance and with respect to misrepresentations, fraudulent conduct, and whether or not the claim damages were merely harmless mistakes, no damage mistakes. And each one of those individual questions relating to affordance satisfaction, the question of damage in the first instance, mitigation of damage, the statute of limitations on fraud, waiver, estoppel, and latches, all of them require individualized proof. And this individualized proof would come from documentary evidence as well as testimonial evidence. The loan application that was in the court below and part of the record in this case, the loan commitment letters and the discussions and correspondence attended to each one of those documents, the meetings with the loan officer for Judy Wheaton in the record testified, the 3,000 pages of record that was before this court in Hamilton versus Ohio Savings, 70 Ohio State Third, testified that she had meetings and explained all of this to her borrowers, attempted to explain all of this to the borrowers. Those conversations, the Truth in Lending Regulation D form, and the discussions and the correspondence relating to that, all of this will be evidence that will be introduced in...
Counsel, all of that said, you're in a heavily regulated industry. Is this a bank for shareholders or is this an association?
Bank for shareholders.
So, has your client gone in and made an analysis of the total potential hit here and had it disclosed that to shareholders or regulators?
Your Honor, this has been disclosed in at least 7 newspaper articles. The Federal Reserve and our regulator is fully aware of everything.
So it wasn't that hard to calculate?
Hard to calculate. Once we determined what was the problem in this particular case, to calculate the difference between amortization under the 365-360 method and the 360-360 method, can be calculated. It was calculated. And in this, you had several questions with respect to the breakout of the 4 subclasses, Your Honor. Subclass, and it's clear in the record, subclass 1 and 2 related to pre-1978 loans that had the amortization problem. It is proposed that Francis Hamilton represents class 1 closed loan and that the Seidel represent subclass 2. Each one of these subclasses have to meet the 7th-tier analysis of Warner versus Waste Management. Subclasses 3 and 4 were the post-1978 after the stake was determined and the payment was set according to the 365-360 method, the same as the amortization method. These two subclasses are closed, 3, open, 4, and there are no representatives for those subclasses. If this court were to certify this case under Rule 23, and if the case were to be tried in that posture, then Rule 23, the procedural rule not intended to affect the substance, would have determined and will determine the facts based upon individual private transactions between Francis Hamilton, George Barber Seidel, and Ohio Savings Bank, the facts with respect to the obligations and rights of the fugitive class members. This is a gamble. If the fact related to Francis Hamilton and Seidel's are better, and their results are better than the fugitive class members' facts, well then, the fugitive class members would have won. If they're worse than the fugitive class members' facts and get a bad result, then the putative class members would be at a detriment.
Well, after notification, any putative class member can join.
That's exactly right. Well, they've been notified with respect to this. But, Your Honor, if they sit back and they allow their claims to be determined on these private, personal, individual, peculiar facts of the Hamiltons and the Seidel, whether they win or lose will be a matter of chance. And it's a gamble, Your Honor, that this court should not endorse. We would ask this court to reverse the court of appeal, affirm the trial judge, and remand this case to the trial court for resolution of the
could use your time to take 30 seconds, if you'd like. Take 30 seconds.
Mr. Stanley is correct that every time somebody goes to a bank and is subjected to a barrage of both identical or nearly identical forms, that there could never be a class action. You could even have a class action under a Truth in Lending Act in this country, even though it is authorized by Congress. Again, these are form contracts entered into in habitual settings.
Mr. Weiss, would class apathy, as shown by the efforts to get some other plaintiffs, and maybe it's the claim, the eventual recovery here that's going to be so darn minimal that people don't care about it, but does class apathy a factor for a trial judge in his discretion to decide, you know what, we're just not going to stir this up because it doesn't seem to be a sufficiently stirring to the folks that we think we're going to help?
Your Honor, I think it is an excellent question. Let me answer it in two ways. Number one, there isn't a case in the, and I'm a student of Rule 23, I've been doing this for a long time, there's not one case in the history of Rule 23, be it federal, state, anywhere, that says class apathy has anything to do with it. The fact that there are no other class members that have joined as files individual students.
Despite efforts, I guess, that we read that there were efforts to
there were no efforts.
Letter, 90 letters or something?
But all that was when the media picked up on the story, those people called my office and I...
They said letters were sent out.
They signed affidavits to try to get to the trial court to restrain class agents from trying to destroy the class. That's what those are the ones that I know about. Anybody that is involved, anybody that is known, whose name appears in the record anywhere, are people that are in contact with my office. But what I'm saying is, no one that doesn't know me is even aware of this. Who would know I think
the brief suggested that one of your clients was charged with sending out letters to try and get other plaintiffs to join.
Not my client, but the person who discovered this is a gentleman named John Clark, both master's degree in both economics and mathematics. What he was saying is that he contacted people to see if their loans had the same problems as his, and they just didn't want to be bothered with who's this guy calling up, doesn't know me, did research on my mortgage and wants to find out. They're not people that even to this day know that there's a lawsuit.
Right.
Okay. There's no one else is filed a lawsuit other than us, and that's one of the criteria to determine superiority.
To make you feel any better at all, he says they're not doing it anymore?
Yes.
Good.
Thank you, Mr. Weiss. The patient submitted to obey the advice or opinion. Mark the court.
All right. Thank you. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session. Ralph Springfield, Ohio. Now stand.